Others will come forward and reply that the natural constitution of mountains is no different from that of trees. Just as trees shed their leaves at certain seasons and put out new growth again at others. Hence the poet's fine saying, "Some leaves the wind scatters on the ground, but the burgeoning wood grows others, when the season of spring comes on." In the same way, parts of mountains are broken off, and other parts grow on in their place. Over long periods of time, this growth becomes noticeable, because trees, having a swifter nature, have their increase perceived more quickly, while mountains, having a slower one, only barely have their growths become perceptible, and only after a long time. They seem, then, to be ignorant of the manner of their formation, since otherwise they would perhaps have been ashamed and kept quiet. There is no reluctance on our part to teach them. What is being said is neither new nor words of our own devising, but the ancient teaching of wise men who left nothing unexamined of what is necessary for knowledge. Whenever the fiery matter enclosed within the earth is driven upward by fire's own natural force, it makes its way toward its proper place. And if it finds even a small breathing passage, it draws up with it a great deal of the earthy substance, as much as it can, and once it emerges outside, it moves more slowly. And having been forced to travel along together with the fire for a long stretch, once raised to its greatest height, it narrows as it tapers, ending in a sharp peak, imitating the shape of fire. For then a forced struggle takes place between the lightest and the heaviest elements, natural opponents clashing together, each hastening toward its own proper region and resisting the force pressing against it. The fire, in drawing the earth up with it, is compelled to become heavy because of the earth's downward-tending weight surrounding it, while the earth, which by nature sinks to the lowest place, is lightened along with the fire's upward tendency and is lifted aloft, and, barely mastered by the stronger power of that which lightens it, is pushed upward toward fire's own seat and stands erect. What wonder is it, then, if the mountains are not worn away by the downpours of rain, since the power that holds them together, the very power by which they also stand erect, grips them very firmly and strongly. For if the binding force that holds them were released, it would be natural for them to dissolve and be scattered by water, but being tightly held by the power of fire, they withstand the downpours of rain all the more securely. Let this, then, be said by us concerning the fact that the irregularity of the earth is no proof of the world's coming to be and destruction. Against the argument mounted from the shrinking of the sea, this could fittingly be said. Do not look only, and always, at islands that have emerged, or at any promontories that, once submerged long ago, later became joined to the mainland. For contentiousness is the enemy of natural philosophy, which holds truth as its most cherished pursuit. Rather, investigate also the opposite. How many regions on the continents, not only coastal but also inland, have been swallowed up by the sea, and how much dry land, having become sea, is now sailed by ships carrying countless cargoes? Are you unaware of the story sung about the most sacred Sicilian strait? Long ago, Sicily was joined to the mainland of Italy, but when the great seas on either side, driven by violent winds, rushed together from opposite directions, the boundary between them was flooded and torn apart, and beside it a city was founded and named Regium Brake after this very event. And the opposite of what one would have expected came about. The seas, previously separate, were joined together and united in their confluence, while the land, previously united, was split apart by the strait that now lies between, and beside it Sicily, once part of the mainland, was forced to become an island. Report says that many other cities besides were made to vanish, swallowed up when the sea rose over them, since in the Peloponnese too they say three cities, Egira, Bura, and lofty Helike, whose walls would soon grow countless seaweed, once prosperous, were overwhelmed by a great onrush of the sea. And the island of Atlantis, greater than Libya and Asia together, as Plato says in the Timaeus, in a single day and night, when there occurred prodigious earthquakes and floods, sank beneath the sea and suddenly vanished, becoming a sea that is not navigable, but a chasm of mud. The supposed shrinking of the sea, then, contributes nothing to the world's being destroyed, for it plainly withdraws from some places while flooding others. One ought to reach a judgment not by observing one of these two phenomena alone, but both together, since even in the disputes of ordinary life, a lawful judge does not render a verdict before hearing both parties to the case. Moreover, the third argument refutes itself, having been improperly framed from the very outset in its premise. For that whose parts perish is surely not thereby perishable, but only that all of whose parts perish together, all at once, and at the same time. Since a man who has had the tip of a finger cut off is not thereby prevented from living, whereas if the whole union of his parts and limbs were destroyed, he would die at once. In the same way, then, if all the elements together vanished all at once at a single moment, one would be bound to admit that the world could suffer destruction. But if each one individually changes into the nature of its neighbor, it is rather made immortal than destroyed, in accordance with the philosophical saying of the tragedian. Nothing of what comes to be dies. Each thing, separating from another, shows forth a different form. It is sheer folly, however, to judge the age of the human race by the arts and crafts. For anyone who follows this absurd line of reasoning will end up declaring the world to be young, having barely come into being a scant 1,000 years ago, since even those we have learned of as the discoverers of the various branches of knowledge do not exceed that stated number of years. But if one is indeed to say that the arts are the exact coevals of the human race, one must say so on the basis of a natural historical account, not carelessly and casually. And what is this account? Destructions of human beings across the earth, not of all of them together, but of most, are attributed to two principal causes, the uncontrollable onrushes of fire and of water. They say each of these strikes in turn, at intervals of very long cycles of years. Whenever, then, a great conflagration takes hold, a stream of ethereal fire, poured out from above, is said to scatter itself in many directions, running across vast regions of the inhabited world. And whenever a flood occurs, the whole nature of water is said to sweep everything away, as native rivers and winter torrents not only overflow, but exceed their usual level of rise, either violently bursting their banks or leaping over them in a rise to an immense height. So that, overflowing, they pour out into the adjoining plain, which at first is divided up into great lakes, as the water keeps settling into the lower-lying hollows, but then, as more water flows in and floods the intervening ridges of land by which the lakes were kept separate, they merge into the vastness of a single boundless sea through the union of the many. And furthermore, as these opposing forces contend in turn, those who dwell in the corresponding regions perish accordingly. By fire, those who live in mountains, on hilly ground, and in places poorly supplied with water, since they naturally lack an abundance of water as a defense against fire. And conversely, by water, those who live along rivers, lakes, or the sea, for calamities are apt to touch their nearest neighbors first, or even only them. In these ways described, then, along with countless other lesser calamities, when the greater part of humankind perishes, the arts too are necessarily lost along with them. For knowledge cannot be seen existing by itself, apart from the one who practices its method. But whenever these general calamities relax their grip, and the human race begins to renew its youth and to sprout again from those not overtaken by the crushing disasters, then the arts too begin to be reconstituted, not coming into being for the first time then, but having become scarce through the diminished numbers of those who possessed them. What we have received concerning the indestructibility of the world, then, has been stated to the best of our ability. The objections to each point must be set forth in what follows. Vlachis,